This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our topic today, a look at the growing epidemic of autism and vaccine-induced injuries since the passage of the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. My guest from San Ramon, California, is Kent Heckenlively. That's H-E-C-K-E-N-L-I-V-E-L-Y. Kent is an attorney. He has a Juris Doctoral degree. He is a science teacher. He's a founding contributor to the Age of Autism, and he's the editor there. He has a daily web newsletter about the autism epidemic, and he is the author of a very important book called Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism, which tells the story of how vaccines have become a 30-year disaster since the passage of Ronald Reagan's 1986 National Vaccine Injury Act. So he is here to talk about what it means to have autism, what is being done, and the question of are they giving the children of America vaccines that we are told are safe and effective but actually cause illnesses, brain damage, central nervous system damage, and the full spectrum of autism-related conditions. Nice to have you with us today, Kent.
Thanks a lot, Gary. I'm really happy to be on your show.
One of the largest complaints people have about the passage of the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act was that it removed all incentive for pharmaceutical companies to perform the necessary due diligence, conduct real gold standard trials to determine vaccine safety and efficacy, and opened doors wider for vaccine to be rapidly fast-tracked onto the market with minimal regulatory review and oversight. And consequently, it was several years after the passage of this act in 1986 when we began to witness the stirrings of what we now call the autism epidemic. Mary Holland argues that vaccination injuries due to all vaccines brought to the market after the Vaccine Injury Act should be the responsibility of the pharmaceutical industry and not the federal government and taxpayers. So please begin by providing us with a bit of background into the passage of this act, who was behind it, who profited from it, follow the money trail, and what was the ultimate motivation for it being passed? And since then, what has been the cost in the greater picture with respect to the health of children since 1986? And if you can provide some statistics as evidence, that'll be helpful. The forum is yours.
Okay. Those are great, great questions, Gary. So first of all, the thing that your listeners should know is that in 1986, Ronald Reagan passed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. What was really interesting in my research was to find out that actually when he signed it, he made a statement in his signing statement that was that in which he said he had serious reservations about the constitutionality of the act, because it didn't have a system of proper checks and balances. And he actually didn't know if it was consistent with the Constitution. In his signing statement, he also said that he hoped that the next Congress would fix it. And I just find that remarkable, because right now, any doctor or pediatrician who knows about the Vaccine Injury Act, you know, they treat it like it's the Magna Carta or the Constitution. And it's not. It's something that even the president who signed it said that there were significant problems with it. It's also interesting that the Justice Department at the time recommended that Reagan veto it for those same constitutional concerns. So, you know, this narrative has developed that even those who know about the Vaccine Injury Act, they act like it's, you know, the flag, apple pie, and motherhood. And it's not. It's a very shaky system. The other interesting thing to know is that even those who are involved in it are concerned about it and don't think it's working. So one of the things that I did was I interviewed one of the special masters, one of the longtime special masters, and the interview is in my book. He didn't want to be identified, so he's anonymous, but he talks about how the system is not working, and I found it really interesting. He gave me a great, honest interview, but I felt like I was interviewing one of those generals who fought the Vietnam War, and you know, he could tell you all the flaws in the battle plans and what went on, but when you asked him the ultimate question of whether, you know, the vaccine court should be continued, he said, I don't feel qualified to answer that. And so I found myself going, wow, even this very senior special master, you know, knows that there are lots of problems with it. It was also interesting because not many legal professionals have studied the vaccine court to look at whether it's working appropriately. But one of them was a professor at Stanford Law School who's published two articles about it. So I did the kind of same thing. And I interviewed her and I said, okay, you know, is this court working the way it was intended to be, meaning that it had two things it was looking to do. One, it was looking to compensate parents quickly, and two, it was designed to remove kind of the antagonism of a typical court system. And her article makes it very clear that it's failing on both counts. A typical tort claim is usually settled within 3 years. There's a judgment, but with a vaccine court, it's 5 years, and the antagonism is, if anything, worse. And so it's kind of interesting because I interview the Stanford law professor and I say, okay, is the court working? No. Does this court provide a model for any other alternative compensation system? No. Should the court be abolished? I don't feel qualified to answer that question. I thought, you're a Stanford law professor, for God's sakes. If you can't defend this thing, who can? And I think there are a number of things that are problematic about it. So my training is as an attorney, and so what I learned is that our system of justice has worked very effectively because we really don't trust anybody. I mean, one of the jokes that, you know, is in the legal profession is if a client tells you his mother loves him, get a second opinion. And so this idea is that any claim must be subject to rigorous cross-examination. Well, the Vaccine Injury Act removed the pharmaceutical companies, first of all, from liability. Okay, so that's one thing. It also removed them from being questioned. So let's say your listeners are making their morning toast and the toaster catches fire and burns down their kitchen. So what they can do is they can sue the manufacturer of the toaster. They can force the company to divulge how many complaints they've had about toasters catching fire. They can depose the engineers who designed the toaster. They can get different engineers who say that's a bad design. They can do all these things. That's with a simple toaster. What we're talking about is vaccines are directly injected into the bloodstreams of children, and you have no right to any of that information. And I just find that absolutely horrific. So let's talk about the court a little bit. Even though it's a very poorly functioning court, it has been working for many years. So let's look at what it's doing. So we have those who are involved in it and the people it's supposed to serve, the parents being very unhappy about it. Your listeners will probably not be surprised to find out that even with all those terrible things in place, the court has paid out $3.2 billion in injuries to the parents of vaccine-injured children. Okay, so do we say that that means the amount of damage is $3.2 billion? Well, there are a number of reasons to think that's a huge underestimate. Let's just take what David Kessler, the former head of the FDA, said in 1993 about pharmaceutical drugs. He said that he thinks that the studies that he's read and his investigations lead him to believe that only 1 to 10% of pharmaceutical drug reactions are reported, okay? So let's take the low end of that. The low end of that means that the real damage is $30 billion. The high end of that is $300 billion. Okay, so that's just if we compare vaccines to a pharmaceutical drug. But I think there's another level of complexity to that argument. The other level of complexity is when you're an adult and you take a pharmaceutical drug and you have a reaction, you have your baseline. You know what you're supposed to be like. That situation is significantly different with a young infant. I mean, these children are, you know, born, they get their first shot, and then, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 months. I think there's another level of complexity. That's another 10 to 100%. So maybe the low end of the damage is $300 billion. Maybe the high end is $3 trillion. And so this is a problem of enormous magnitude. It's bad law has made for this terrible situation. So when I heard about the whistleblower story of Dr. William Thompson turning over all these documents to Congress, showing that the scientists at the CDC made a profoundly immoral decision not to report the results of earlier administration of the MMR vaccine causing autism in African-American males, I saw this as an opportunity to attack the bigger question that I had never seen anybody do in a book, which is to say this is to make a direct attack on the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, to use that story as a lens to get to the bigger picture of why this bad law made it also inevitable that you would have scientists like Thompson and others of the CDC lying about vaccine reactions.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. Many of us who criticize vaccine efficacy and safety are educated about the medical dangers associated with vaccination, and we agree that the so-called vaccine court is grossly, and I believe intentionally, flawed. The majority of claims for childhood vaccine injuries are denied, irrespective of the evidence. It is not actual court that is doing this, but a review board, to my knowledge, made up of individuals who are compromised by biases of selection by the government and who adhere to the vaccine, do no harm, always positive, always good mythology. These are nothing more, in my personal opinion, than industry supporters, the pharmaceutical industry supporters, the vaccine industry supporters. Now, you've had a chance to meet and interview two individuals who have shed light on the flaws in both the Injury Act and this court. One was a special master on the vaccine court, and the other was a person who was supposed to be a Stanford law professor who studied the court and who stated that it doesn't work. So first, describe what the vaccine court is, who's on it, how are they selected, and then share what you learned from these two individuals that show that, in my opinion, it's a complete failure and gives good reason for having it completely abolished, and then stripping away the indemnification so that the manufacturers of vaccines are held personally liable for every time they injure a person.
You know, those are great questions. What was really interesting in talking to the special master is he really thought that at the time the vaccine court was set up, it was a structure that could possibly have worked. And here's the reason he thought it could work. He thought it could work because the deal that they made was that there would be a very generous table of injuries for vaccine injuries. So the whole idea of the court was to be extremely inclusive, okay? And in fact, he also talked about the compensated vaccine injuries, which include autism. And this blew my mind during the interview. So I said to him, look, there's been reports and published literature, specifically in the Pace University Environmental Law Review, that the vaccine court has compensated vaccine injuries, which include autism, that vaccines have caused autism. I said, could you speak to that for me? And he said, that is categorically false, and it's been misreported. And I said, okay, tell me what the truth is. And he said, what we have done from the earliest days is we have compensated vaccine injuries which show evidence of encephalopathy, and the damages from encephalopathy can be, or swelling of the brain, that's encephalopathy, can include autism. So, you know, I'm just going nuts at this because I'm thinking like, my God, so basically you're saying vaccines can cause brain swelling and encephalopathy, and the damages from encephalopathy can cause autism, and you're cool with that. Yeah, exactly. That's the way you say it. You know, in my mind, I'm going, you just said vaccines cause autism because, you know, yeah, there's one intermediate step in the middle of that, brain swelling, for God's sakes. And so that was stunning to me. It was also stunning to me to hear that in 1991, that the table of injuries changed, and suddenly all of these cases were thrown to causation in fact. And so when he's gone to Congress to testify about this, he's basically said, what we need to do is we need to increase the table of injuries, make it generous again. I still think that's a recipe for disaster. But in his mind, that's why things went so bad. What was interesting in the William Thompson stuff, and this goes to what are these people thinking, and why I was so happy that Congress granted me the right to review the documents that Thompson had turned over, is to see that scientists at the CDC, when they first set out to investigate the MMR question, they came up with a really good plan. I mean, it was scientifically solid. And so that makes me think that at the time, they honestly believed that the MMR vaccine was not linked to autism. The problem came when they got the data back from this well-designed study, and it showed a link between earlier administration of the MMR vaccine and autism. And that's the point at which I think that they made a profoundly immoral decision. And that profoundly immoral decision was to remove as many of the kids as possible to get the odds ratio to go down to a number that they could somewhat defend. So the odds ratio they reported in the paper was about 1.5, I believe, or 1.8. And usually you start talking about causation above 2.0. With the African-American males, it was the real number was around 3.4, so it's just devastating. So I think that what happened is that at the time, they had this belief that vaccines were not linked to autism, but they designed a scientifically defensible study. Well, when they got that back, they then decided to hide it. So to my mind, that is the moment where science lost its soul, because science has a sacred obligation to tell the truth without fear or favor. It doesn't care about who it hurts or who it helps. It just is. So when these scientists engaged in this, what I call a crime against humanity, it was also a crime against science. It's a crime against truth. And it's had profound impacts on our society. And, you know, when Thompson, thank God he turned over this stuff, you know, I looked at this the way a prosecuting attorney looks at going after the mob. I mean, my book is basically a RICO case in narrative. This is how the cartel, this cabal, is harming our children and our society. One of the really interesting things that Brian Hooker had said, and this is where I think it's a much larger issue than autism, is he said that Thompson at one point asked the CDC if he could investigate the vaccines in Alzheimer's disease, rates of vaccinations in the elderly population, rates of Alzheimer's. They denied him the chance to look at that data, which to Hooker suggested they know that vaccines are linked to Alzheimer's disease too, and probably a lot of other problems. So, you know, I am so thankful, Gary, that you agreed to have me on your show so I could talk to your listeners. But I also have to say, one of the things that's been so exciting to me is I've got a great publicist. We are just deluged with radio interviews. So many good people like you are putting me on the radio that, I'm hoping that I stir up this hornet's nest. I'm banging the drum loudly, and I want to get Thompson in front of Congress, and I want everybody in America to know this story. And it's why I wrote the book the way I did. I mean, people tell me it reads Kent, like a political thriller.
Kent, this is a question for you as an educated person. After all, you have a doctor of jurisprudence. You're also a scientist. You teach science. I would like your opinion as to why, with the thousands of studies in the peer-reviewed literature in toxicology and immunotherapy, we see that there is not a single ingredient in any of the vaccines that have been proven safe. To the contrary, there are thousands of these studies showing their toxic effects, especially with aluminum and mercury, as neurotoxic, toxic to the central nervous system, toxic to the mitochondria, toxic to the gut bacteria, toxic to the brain and the brain stems. And yet, the vast majority of people in the autism community and the challenged vaccine community are still pro-vaccine. In fact, in the movie Vaxxed, Robert Kennedy goes out of his way, as does Andrew Wakefield, to explain how they are pro-vaccine. And having done a six-hour special defending Andrew Wakefield in a one-hour debate debating Brian Deer, Andrew Wakefield's chief antagonist and attacker, and the one who caused him to lose his medical license, and after doing over 2 years of investigation prior to doing this six-hour special, because it's very rare on radio to have a six-hour special. In fact, I'm not aware there's ever been one. And still at the end of that, when we presented all this information on there are no gold standard studies ever on the safety and efficacy of vaccines. They're using one vaccine against another, which is not a gold standard. They're not looking at the toxicological data at all, as if it doesn't exist. And they're not looking at the truth within immunology, that if you're vaccinated and you don't get a disease from which you're being vaccinated, you cannot contribute the vaccine for having prevented that. It'd be no different than I saying, well, Kent, this year, take vitamin C 1,000 milligrams a day, and you do, and at the end of the year, you don't get a cold or flu. I could not, in any responsible way, say, the only reason Kent didn't get a cold or the flu is because he took vitamin C, so let's give all the efficacy to vitamin C. That would be absurd. And yet that's exactly how the CDC and the National Institutes of Health compile the data on the efficacy of these vaccines. Someone given the vaccine doesn't get the condition, is now automatically given 100% credit to the vaccine. That's voodoo science. That's alchemy science. That's not real science. Why is it that the vaccine community hasn't awakened to this reality yet? Your thoughts, please.
You know, Gary, I'm really happy you make that point, because I have argued along the same lines that you've argued, which is that, you know, here I am an attorney, and I'm looking at all this evidence, and I'm looking for any evidence of safety for vaccines. And I look at this 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which is a complete abomination, and I find myself saying, I don't understand why those people in my community will do the, hey, we know vaccines have done a lot of great things dance, and then go on over to the other side. I'm saying to myself, look, I'm an educated person. I've looked at the evidence. I've reviewed the flaws in the system, and I just cannot intellectually come to the point where I can say that vaccines are good. I just can't get there, because I don't see any evidence that it's been studied properly. I see a lot of evidence of harm to people. And so, you know, it's kind of like saying, hey, look, I got into a car with a drunk driver, and we smashed up the car, and I'm going to get into the car with another drunk driver. No. Let's make sure the driver isn't drunk first. One of the things that really kind of got me was, in my book, I look not just at the MMR study that was corrupted by what scientists did at the CDC, but I also look at the Simpsonwood transcripts on mercury. And again, I find this thing that it really does seem like at the beginning of this investigation into mercury that they didn't quite know what they were going to find, and they were actually surprised by the initial results that they got. Some people later said this study should never have been done because it could have been predicted, but the people who put the study together didn't seem to think that they would find such an effect. So I think to myself, okay, let's look at how the CDC has done two big studies on vaccines and some of their ingredients. So they did Simpson Wood, and then they lost the initial data set, the first-generation data, and found evidence of harm. And then they did it with MMR, and they found evidence of harm. And I'm saying to myself, you know, I'm sorry, this is like a corrupt bank president telling you they've got $100 million in assets, and you go and look at the books, and, you know, they got nothing there. When I look at what the CDC has done with vaccines in collaboration with the pharmaceutical companies, to me, this is one of the greatest crimes against humanity ever. And so, you know, I do part ways with people who, you know, want to do the, hey, vaccines are great dance, because I just don't see any evidence that convinces me that they are great in any reasonable way. So, you know, I say, you know, until I see evidence that vaccines are great, I just can't recommend them at all.
I might add on to what you just said here, Kent, that when I speak with the following people, Dr. Nancy Banks, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, for example, and I'm finding people who've done over 10 to 15,000 hours of in-depth research. In effect, they're putting their medical license and their reputation on the line. They have a lot to lose. And yet, after they looked at the data, they told me, and Tony Bark the same, that the overwhelming the preponderance of evidence showed that vaccines cannot be proven individually or in combination to be safe based upon the ingredients in them, nor is there compelling evidence that a vaccine can be determined to be efficacious in any given individual. And if the vaccine industry really believed that they were safe and effective, then they would stop indemnifying themselves and allow themselves to be held liable in case there is injury, and then let courts with scientists come forward and they can present their evidence. But they're not willing to do that. They're willing to hide behind the idea that you cannot sue them. But they also control the media. I'm embarrassed by how CNN and Anderson Cooper, specifically and Dr. Gupta, and all the network, including Pacifica, including many programs on Pacifica, will automatically accept that whatever authorities are saying from official institutions or departments, it must be accurate. And anyone like myself, who's on the outside, or you, or the others, if we offer an argument, we're offering the argument by already being tainted. We are the quacks. For decades, they called us quacks. Or we are the pseudoscientists, irrespective of the quality of our science. Now, I publish in peer-reviewed journals. I've done more clinical studies, non-medical clinical studies, but medically supervised, on lifestyle and behavior modification on different diseases than anyone else I'm aware of in American history, over 40. And the last one just finished where we had major results. And yet they never once invite you on to talk about, well, Gary, exactly what happened after a year putting women who were postmenopausal on an anti-menopausal program. What happened to their night sweats and their sagging skin and their muscle loss and their loss of libido and their loss of energy and their hair falling out? What happened? You'll never have that. But if a doctor goes on there to talk about some medication that's been shown to benefit one single symptom in a person, suddenly that's important news because the good doctor came on. And so there's an institutional bias. Now, that said, I also want to give you a little story, and I'd like your feedback on it, Kent.
Sure.
I did a study on the brain. This was a lifestyle and behavior modification study. To get into the study, you had to have your doctor's permission and you had to have a medical condition for more than 5 years that was non-reversible. Not necessarily terminal, but you couldn't reverse it. Like end-stage Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, myasthenia gravis, etc. We had over 40 people in the study. The study lasted 16 months. At the end of the study, we had people, for example, who I presented to a group of over, well, it was anywhere, but I didn't get the exact number, but I was told it was over 3,000 and may have been as many as 7,000 scientists in Washington, D.C. The entire room was packed, this giant auditorium. I was one of the presenters, and I got up there. Instead of doing my 22-minute presentation, I instead invited out onto the stage a young fella, a teenager, and with his mother and father, both New York City police officers, and his name is Ortega, Jonathan Ortega. And Jonathan had some papers, and I said, Jonathan, what are the papers? He said, well, these are where outstanding student of the month. For how many months? 10 months. At a very famous school, very hard school. And I said, and what do you like to do each day? And he talked about he loved making breakfast for the whole family, healthy breakfast, playing the piano, playing the guitar, working on crossword puzzles, etc. And I could see suddenly the audience is looking at me, what's going on here? And I said, now, here's what you don't know. Jonathan had very advanced autism spectrum disorder. He had not spoken in 12 years. And he was large, and he had very extreme energy, so his parents had him on 4 anti-psychotic medications or anti-mood medications, very extreme. And they were going to have put him on a 5th or put him in some kind of home because he was too big to be taken care of by his family anymore. Now he's completely normal. And when I say completely normal, completely normal. And I said, so this is not an exception. This is reversing autism is entirely doable. But I said, you have to look outside of the mainstream to do it. You even have to look outside of Pam and some of the other groups of medical doctors who are using the very limited methods like B12 and folic acid, but not really understanding how to rebalance brain chemistry or how to repair the damage to the mitochondria and the neurons that others of us who work on this do. And then I brought another woman, and she talked about her joy in art. She was a curator for Lloyd's of London. She was an instructor at New York University, but she had end-stage Alzheimer's, and now she was, for all intents and purposes, fully functional. She had her memory back, cognition back, awareness back. She could read. Before, she said, when she would go to a museum where historically she had taken students and spent time explaining each of the great historical paintings, all she could see was just color. And so I said, I've been listening today to some of you talking about your research grants where you want to find out what will happen with stem cell therapy to some of the elements of the brain. Here you got whole people. And then I brought another person who had reversed hepatitis B, herpes 1, 2, and 6, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, chronic fatigue syndrome, etc., who was a 40-year practicing oncology nurse who talked about all this. So I said, here are living examples, real people who had major conditions that orthodox medicine had no answer for, but today are living happy, healthy, functional lives. Now, all you have to have is one to prove it's possible. You don't have to have 10,000. But from that one, you can then see who else using the same protocols can come to the same awarenesses. Shortly thereafter, I interviewed Bob Wright. I got a call from Bill Cosby, and before his scandal, this is years ago, and he said, I heard that you're doing some good work helping people with autism. I said, that's correct. He said, in 5 minutes, you're going to get a call from the president of NBC, Bob Wright. I said, okay. So 5 minutes later, I get a call from Bob Wright. He says, I hear you can help people with autism. I said, yes. He said, well, you're going to get a call from the head of a foundation. I got a call from the head of this foundation on autism. And I explained the protocol to the person. And what I knew was that this relative, his son's son, was being given holistic treatment down in Dallas at a center there, because I knew the person ran the center. Jump ahead a couple months, and Bob Wright is heading an autism awareness panel at the UN. I got word of that, and so I took my camera crew over, and we got upstairs and where the media is, and there's no media, zero. I was the only one filming, so we filmed it. And what was interesting is here comes Bob Wright, and he's talking about autism, but we need more money for a pharmaceutical approach. It's all about getting the good right drugs. So after this flabbergasting statements, I went downstairs, and we caught him just going out the door, and I said, Mr. Wright, I said, we haven't met in person. I'm Gary Nall. I said, but why didn't you mention the success of your son's son in his treatment? Why didn't you mention that their natural and non-toxic approaches also? You had a worldwide audience here. You had policymakers in the world of autism from all over the world. Not a message of that. And he gave me some gibberish and left. And it showed me how much politics has invaded the autism movement, and then how many of the autism groups are promoting a drug approach rather than a more natural, non-toxic approach to autism. And I just see this as an enormous challenge for those who've seen the benefits of a natural, non-toxic approach versus let's give hundreds of millions of dollars to drug companies to come up with a magic panacea. Could you address this, please?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because what has struck me most strongly is the corruption of science in autism. And all I can say is, when you see really bad science being done, I just love science. I mean, I always say science has a sacred obligation to tell the truth. I mean, that's something I hold so close to my heart. I mean, it's what I dedicate my life to, is teaching science, because I love the principles of it. And to see the corruption of science, especially when it comes to children, it's overwhelming to me. I mean, it really gets me, because I say to myself, you know, these are supposed to be healers, and all I can think of is, you know, to some extent, they're charlatans. You know, they're politicians, because they're not going where the evidence leads them. And I struggle with the question of why. And, you know, I come back to a couple things. First of all, I love reviewing the Milgram experiments that were done, I believe at Stanford or at Yale, where all they had was a person in a white jacket instructing people that they needed to ask a series of questions to somebody in another room. And if that person didn't answer correctly, they would get an increasing amount of electric shocks. And because the scientists want to answer the question, how could regular Germans have participated in the atrocities in Nazi Germany? And what they thought is, oh, good Americans would never, you know, give electric shocks to the point where it seems like you kill somebody. And they thought no more than 1% of the people will do it. But they found that about 60% of the people would do it, just because they were being told by somebody in a white jacket to do it. I think a lot of the same psychology is going on with autism and science. And I would take Milgram's experiment a little bit farther, which is, I think the more educated you are, the more you would follow the directions of that person in the white jacket, no matter what they said. So I think if you got 100 graduates of the Ivy League and subjected them to Milgram's experiment, I would hazard to guess that 98% of them would keep pushing that button till it seemed to be an electric shock that killed the person on the other side. It didn't really. It was just an actor on the other side. I think if you got a bunch of blue-collar guys, I'm thinking it'd probably be around 40%. So I see this in my students, because I work at a school which is a very high-performing school, And it kind of gets me because I see all the good students wanting to please me as the teacher. And, you know, that's a fine thing. They want to do well in everything. But I also am so aware of this terrible sort of thing that when you have smart people who are living and dying for the pats on the head I will give them, you know, that's terrifying to me. I want those students who want to make me happy, but I also want the ones who are going to challenge me, who to say, you're wrong on this. And I think that our education system really rewards conformity. It rewards giving the right answer. And, you know, I think it's a terrible thing that's going on. We're losing our respect for the rebels and the people who see things differently. We're calling them troublemakers. I mean, I always say, gee, you know, if I had said to my family and friends, you know, God, my daughter had a bad reaction to Robitussin, for God's sake. She had a seizure after Robitussin. They go, oh, my God, maybe Robitussin is terrible. Let's look into this. You know, but I say it with vaccines, and, you know, I get crickets. And, you know, I come from a very well-educated family. But I think there is an inherent blindness in the system that we've created, that we create people who are very smart and, you know, well-organized. You know, they file their taxes on time. They do everything on time. But they're also incredibly compliant. They don't ask questions. And, you know, I always think about, I think it's Ignaz Semmelweis out of Austria, who before the germ theory of disease came around, he in his hospital, he found that the women were not dying at the same rates, high rates, from childbirth as they were in other hospitals. And he found that, well, gee, the midwives are seeming to have a much lower death rate for the women who they deliver babies to than the regular doctors. And he's saying, well, why is that? Because, I mean, that's the great thing about science. It's supposed to be a question. So he goes and he finds that, wow, you know, the regular doctors are doing dissections of cadavers and then going to deliver babies. Maybe there's something that's getting on their hands from dissecting cadavers. It's causing problems when they deliver a child and giving these, you know, pregnant mothers infections. And so, you know, he institutes a hand-washing policy, and, you know, wow, you know, the rates of death go down 90%, so only 10% of the women are dying in his hospital compared to the regular hospitals. And he can't believe that, he can't understand why none of the other doctors are flocking to him and saying, wow, you know, you can't explain exactly why, but there's some very profound effect. And Semmelweis ends up going insane, basically, and it's only 30 years later when his work is rediscovered, and they have the infectious, the microbial theory of disease, that they say, wow, gee, maybe something like cleanliness has something to do with disease rates. So I think there's always been this blindness, blind trust in authority, and it really is up to people like you and me, Gary, to challenge that authority, to get people to listen to us, and to keep fighting the fight, because, you know, the truth is the truth. And I really think that more and more people are getting it. The numbers are still absurdly small. But
you understand that they have a proprietary patent on the truth in official Washington. Kent, since you have worked in federal and local government offices, you'd have a greater idea of the kinds of bureaucratic obstacles erected for elected officials to avoid critical issues demanding investigation and review. And the most outrageous issue and concerted act of denial has been the complacency and perhaps intentional neglect of congressional subcommittees to investigate the trove of Dr. William Thompson's data brought forth showing corruption and cover-up of vaccine-induced autism at the CDC. And another case has been the matter of the federal law enforcement stymied by powers in our health agencies or higher-ups to bring the fugitive Dr. Paul Thorsen to justice for fraud, embezzlement, and money laundering. And to this day, Thorsen skewed published papers to discredit a thimerosal, meaning Mercury Autism Association, that were funded by the CDC are still cited as authoritative studies proving vaccine mercury is safe. So can you explain to us the political mechanisms in place within our federal health agencies that have such power to silence Congress from investigating matters concerning autism and vaccines?
Well, I'm going to go on two different tracks here, okay? And to some extent, that they'll be a little bit at odds with each other, but give me a little bit of space here. So I think it really matters who's at the top, okay? So who the president is matters. And I don't, this is against Republicans and against Democrats. So the thing that has recently given me some hope is that during the presidential campaign, Donald Trump actually met with Andy Wakefield. They had a long discussion. He promised to watch Vax. He promised that if he won, there would be further meetings at the White House. If we have somebody at the presidential level who gives us the time of day, I think that's going to open things up. Okay, so that's one thing. I'm also aware that oftentimes politicians will promise us things and then do nothing. For example, in 2008, both Obama and Hillary had publicly stated that the question of vaccines and autism need to be investigated. Obama even promised an autism czar. Well, you know, he's got, what, 45 days left and we still have no autism czar? So I'm not necessarily putting my faith in politicians, but I'm saying it does matter who's at the top if they're willing to make a fight. Okay, so that's one side of the issue. The other side of the issue is we need to figure out the ways that we can bring attention to this issue. We need to find out those ways to raise the profile of it. So in publishing my book, and I'm so happy because I'm getting on so many radio shows, is I feel like I'm doing those things to raise the profile of the issue in a lot of different ways. And I always like to, one of my favorite writers is Malcolm Gladwell, and he's got a book called David versus Goliath. And so what he says is everybody thinks of the David and Goliath story as, oh, my God, David got so lucky just because, you know, that with that one shot he hit Goliath in the head with the rock and then cut his head off. And Malcolm Gladwell went back at it and he says, no, look, we got the David and Goliath story all wrong. Goliath's power was that he was big and he had all this armor on and, you know, he had a big sword. But in the Bible story, it actually seems like Goliath is essentially blind, okay, which might be, explain why he's so large, because there's a condition where you get large, but one of the problems is you can hardly see. So David is looking at this and he says, oh, my God, I got a blind giant there. Okay? And if I go and fight the giant the way they want me to fight the giant, so King Saul actually offers David some armor to fight with. And it's like, no, I can't fight the giants the way the giant fights. Well, David is a shepherd boy, and what he does is he protects the flocks at night from things like wolves and lions and bears. And they actually studied the sling that David likely used, and they found out, you know, if you get good at that, it's pretty accurate. And that rock that flies out has about as much force as a bullet fired from a pistol. So if we reimagine the David and Goliath story as a teenager with a pistol against a blind giant, well, 99 times out of 100, that teenager is going to win. And so what we have to do is we have to figure out, how do we not play the giant's game? How do we change the struggle? Same thing with the American Revolution. If we fought the British the way the British fought wars, it would have been a very short-lived revolution. Washington realized he had to fight not like a European army. He had to fight like the Native Americans fought the Americans. So he fought a guerrilla war. Well, if you fight the giant in a way that the giant doesn't want you to fight, your chances actually are pretty good. And Gladwell goes into a number of military conflicts, and he says, look, I can show you that you've got an enemy that has a 10-to-1 advantage over at the other opponent. If the other opponent fights the way the giant wants you to fight, well, they're going to lose. But if they fight in a non-traditional way, they got about a 60% chance of winning. So I think that we have to figure out, and if there's one thing I can say about the autism community, I have to say is they've fought the way our enemy wants us to fight. They say to themselves, oh, let me publish in this journal, let me do this, let me do that. And they're going to get wiped out. So, you know, I've been going in a different way, publishing books, getting on radio shows that I know will let me speak and have a voice. So I'm not caring about getting on CNN or Fox News or anything like that. You know, I'm going with the little guys who I know I can get on, and some of them are actually really big, but they're a little bit out of the mainstream science. And I think that's a kind of strategy which has a much greater chance of success than what I've seen a lot of my contemporaries try to do, which is they say, let me try and get some love from the networks. The networks ain't going to give you any love. But you have to figure out a different network to get this war won.
I agree with that, Kent. And I thank you very much for the good work. And the book is Inoculated, How Science Lost Its Soul in Autism. And we look forward to another conversation. So all the best to you in your travels and educating the public about the truth behind the lack of science and integrity and honesty in the issue of vaccines and our public health issues.
Thank you very much, Gary.
And that's Stanford graduate law in law plus a science teacher, Kent Heckens-Lively. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening to Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me, sister, with brutality. Sister, talk to me, sister, so you can see, sister, oh, what's going on. They judge us simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know that we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. can't see what's going on.
Right.